One of the big questions people are asking in this conversation about homelessness and affordability is, can we trust the city to spend its money effectively? A new report from Seattle University's Homeless Rights Advocacy Project says Seattle is not spending on the right things. And I have the director of Seattle University's Homeless Rights Advocacy Project here with me now, Professor Sarah Rankin. Welcome.
Thank you.
One of your main arguments is that we should focus on lowering the barrier to get people into housing. Will you tell us what is low barrier housing?
Low barrier housing, and it's important to put the emphasis both on low barrier and housing. We're not talking about low barrier shelters.
Yes. What's the difference?
The difference is that low barrier, especially what you would see in something called Housing First programs, don't require people to accept services or treatment or any other precondition to having access to permanent supportive housing.
What are those preconditions typically?
Typically, we would require people to fix themselves of whatever substance addiction they may have, for them to get on top of mental illness, for them to fix other signs, common signs of trauma that exist in populations experiencing homelessness. It's an unrealistic expectation.
So a low barrier housing is an apartment, a single occupancy? This is partners, friends, children? Who's there?
There's many different models across the country. As I mentioned, if your listeners are interested, they can Google Housing First and they'll see the diversity of approaches that are being taken across the country. So they can be apartments, they can be communal living. But the key key thread that runs through all of them is that they don't have preconditions to participation. And this is not just kumbaya feeling good approach. We know from science and from studies, extensive, rigorous analysis of Housing First approaches, that it is the most effective way of dealing with chronic homelessness, and it results in huge savings to taxpayers.
And we'll talk about why that would be. And is this a rent-free apartment, a sliding scale? Can someone live there forever?
Again, it depends on the program. Some programs, once you get a job, will ask you to contribute some percentage of your income. Some programs operate for a number of months. Some programs have no length of time.
Mm-hmm.
And it really varies. And that's what makes it so successful, is it's a very flexible model.
You mentioned that residents don't have to kick an addiction. Is there alcohol use allowed in those in the housing? And what about illegal drugs?
There's no conditions at all.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, you can drink there. Again, the rules, the very specific rules, will vary about what people can be doing. But what we've seen, what's so important about this, is that what we've seen is, by providing people the stability of Housing First and not requiring them to accept services or treatment as a precondition to receiving that housing, that eventually, once people get that stability, they pursue the treatment and services at a higher rate, and they rates of recidivism are much lower than we would see if they weren't experiencing the stability of housing.
And we have some low barrier housing examples in Seattle.
Yes.
So why aren't there more on the scale that you'd like to see low barrier housing in Seattle?
Well, you can talk to Daniel Malone at the DESC and Paul Ambrose.
Downtown Emergency Services.
Yes, Center. And Plymouth Housing are two excellent examples, very different approaches to the way that they implement the Housing First model. But they need more money, they need more facilities, they need more space. And the key to that is not just revenue, but also community support for the siting of those facilities.
Yes, community support for the siting. That's a little jargony sounding. What it can mean is, who wants to be next to low barrier housing? People who live there have said they are magnets for crime. So let's start there. What do you say to that?
The studies that I've seen show that there is no significant I'm trying to use easy language. I was going to say correlation. There's no significant correlation between Housing First or other authorized, housing facilities for people who are experiencing chronic homelessness associated with those in the surrounding communities.
One shelter manager, Frank Morrison, said about this, about the low barrier approach, most humans will try to take the easier path. If we crack the door becomes wide open for some people and they'll just use the system. What about that idea that people who, for example, are addicted or are just, making poor decisions, they've got to hit rock bottom instead of being enabled?
So Housing First totally rebuts the enabling, sort of narrative that you're talking about. Again, people who take part in Housing First programs not only have a higher rate of eventually accepting treatment and services, but when they do that on their own time, the way that they stick with the treatment and services and the overall impact that it has on their health and their social outcomes is much more resilient than if we don't.
And why is that?
It's because people have to be ready. You can't force someone to be able to focus on a secondary trauma. Those things that we're talking about are really secondary traumas to the primary traumas that they're experiencing by virtue of living on the street.
What are primary traumas?
But living on the street, having no privacy, having no safety, having no security. Living on the street in and of itself is an extraordinary trauma. So that's one of the reasons why it's so important to prevent people from becoming homeless in the first place. Is there's a lot of science that shows the second that you are living on the street, the chances of your trauma manifesting itself as mental illness, manifesting itself as turning to self-medication, or manifesting itself as being pulled through the jail system skyrocket. So we really want to keep people off the street to begin with.
Well, then what about the cheaper alternative of authorized encampments, where you could say it's on the street in a way, but it's different because it's some kind of temporary shelter. It's people in community. It's people not being kicked out, and displaced.
Right. So, the ultimate solution, there's sort of fights among folks who work on homeless rights advocacy about whether we ever want to focus on interim solutions. The ultimate solution, the priority, is really affordable housing and Housing First, bringing those models to scale so that people have a permanent, stable place to be. Now, I'm a pragmatist, so I think we can have conversations about ultimate solutions and at the same time know, especially in a place like Seattle where we like to argue things to death at the expense of actually doing anything. I like to talk also about interim solutions, and authorized encampments are a proven successful way of doing that. Even the city's own evaluations of the authorized encampments suggest that they have a higher rate of placing people in permanent housing than even at the time that I saw the evaluation, even than the navigation center or other forms of intervention. So they can be extremely effective interim solutions. And one of our reports dives deep into authorized encampments.
Okay. Again, we're talking with Professor Sarah Rankin. She's a law professor at Seattle University. She's also the director of the university's Homeless Rights Advocacy Project. And we're talking about solutions. And, of course, there are more than one approach to Seattle's homelessness crisis. So what's your vision? So if the city did, and you have to make a number of recommendations. We just talked about authorized encampments. We talked about low barrier housing. Are you saying that if the city spent its money the way you would like, that so many people would leave the streets for these low barrier homes that tents would, disappear from bridges and parks and sidewalks? People wouldn't be sleeping in alleys and benches? What's your vision in Seattle?
I do think that we can solve the homelessness crisis by providing housing for people. It's not just me. It's not just what I would want. It's essentially what anyone who spends a lot of time looking at what the studies say would want. So my vision would be increasing our investments in affordable housing, just like the McKinsey report recommends. In fact, the McKinsey Institute has recommendations for what cities can do to improve investments and to increase affordable housing, but also to invest more heavily in Housing First programs. DESC, which we just talked about, and Plymouth Housing are underfunded and need more space. So if we could bring Housing First to scale and we invested adequately in affordable housing, I do think you would see a visible difference in our chronic homeless population.
It might sound as if we're talking about people being just moved around, as if they don't have autonomy. What about people who they don't want to deal with an apartment and a landlord?
I have yet to meet anyone who is suffering from homelessness and the trauma of daily existence on the street who says, you know what I don't want to deal with is a landlord. If people are given a meaningful offer of permanent supportive housing, the vast majority of people will accept that offer. The difference is the way that we go about things now is we require services or treatment. We tell someone, you know what I can give you? I can give you outreach. I can require you to accept services or treatment.
I can give you a referral.
And actually, a lot of times, even those referrals turn out to be smoke and mirrors because we'll find out that the person that has been recommended that referral is ineligible for that service or shelter, or they can't get to that service or shelter. And so what people experiencing homelessness often learn through experience is that offers of services and shelter are false, that they're non-existent. And so then you get this sort of learned apathy, where even when a real offer of meaningful service or shelter comes along, people have already, and reasonably and logically, through experience, learned not to accept it. But if people understood that there was a meaningful offer of supportive housing that didn't require them.
What does supportive mean?
Supportive housing is an example of housing first. It's sort of a term of art that means that housing has some wraparound services that are available for people who want to avail themselves.
Like what?
Mental health services, drug addiction treatment, job services, job placement services, educational supports, all sorts of supports that really...
So someone knocks on your door and says, hey, we want to help, here's places you can go, but it's not a barrier, it's not a requirement, it's not a barrier to entry.
I got caught up on the knocking on the door.
I'm just wondering how when we say wraparound service, how what's the interaction like with the person who we want to come off the street? And then what? Then what happens? Because some people say, okay, so you've moved them into an apartment where they're unsupervised. That's the imagination of some people who don't understand. I read to you the comment from the shelter manager saying people will just take the easy way. Mm-hmm. What does life become like for that person who's now in this home?
Well, you're not just left to your own devices and no one ever talks to you again. You know, the notion is that you want to be able to build a supportive community that doesn't require people to do stuff, but makes it very clear to the residents that there are those services available when they're ready. And so it's not unlike in some ways that a lot of your listeners have probably taken elders to assisted living facilities. In the ideal world, a lot of the Housing First programs are something like that, where people aren't just left to sort of fester in their rooms by themselves, but at the same time,
there's a common room, and right
there can be all sorts of ways that they build community and support into the actual infrastructure of the facility.
When Starbucks came out against the new head tax on business, the senior vice president John Kelly accused Seattle of ignoring the plight of children sleeping outside. He said, quote, if the city cannot provide a warm meal and safe bed to a 5-year-old child, no one believes they'll be able to make housing affordable or address opiate addiction. Do you agree that Seattle should get all children into housing before childless adults?
I don't think we need to prioritize at all. I think the goal here should really be getting everyone off of the street. I certainly believe that we have a serious crisis with respect to homeless youth. But with all due respect to Starbucks, you know, that sort of response to the head tax is a bit of a bait and switch. It's trying to play on people's emotions, thinking about children. But it's the same thing that happens in a lot of discussions about homelessness, where you'll see it go the other way, playing on fear. People worrying about, there was a recent coverage of someone who was unfortunately raped, and the coverage really stressed the fact that this guy was homeless.
Yeah, but like, separate from the fear, though, the Starbucks executive's point, I think, is that there's not unlimited money. The city has to prioritize. So you should. You should prioritize people, young people who didn't make these choices, don't have a say in the matter, and can be traumatized for, you know, decades to come by things that happen to them because they're homeless children. That is worthy of priority.
That's absolutely true. Children had no choice, and neither do survivors of domestic violence, who are the leading, sort of representatives of homeless women. Neither do veterans who come back with PTSD and, a lack of social network. So when we get into a battle about who's the most worthy, it plays sort of on our worst instincts, thinking about the only way that we want to be able to talk about housing is to focus on who's worthy. And something we haven't covered yet, which is so important for your listeners to understand, because some people will not be persuaded by the notion that housing is a human right and that we can actually make an enormous difference in the lives of people who are suffering. So if that doesn't persuade you, you have to be persuaded by the exhaustive research that shows that it costs taxpayers less to house people who are experiencing homelessness than it does to leave them where they are. And that's because we know that if you leave people where they are, the Housing First studies all show that Housing First, housing people who are chronically homeless, regardless of whether we deem them worthy, saves money because it stops people from being churned through emergency services, emergency shelters, and the criminal justice system. Those are the by far the most expensive and least effective ways of addressing homelessness, but it has for too long been our priority in Seattle to take that approach.
We'll keep having this conversation. We invite people who are listening to you now and have other points of view. This is an ongoing discussion. Our email address, record@kuow.org, and we're on Twitter @KUOW, and I'd like to talk to you again, too, and follow this along, Professor.
Thank you so much.
Sarah Rankin, Professor of Law, Seattle University, Director of the Seattle University Homeless Rights Advocacy Project. Talk to you soon.
Thank you.